This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the whole basis for the millions of words and two maddening years of Russiagate has collapsed, but the near state of war between the two nuclear superpowers continues. We'll speak with a researcher who studies African women at war. And a Haitian activist explains why the people want their U.S.-backed government to step down.
But first, anti-war forces have converged on the nation's capital to denounce the aggressive policies of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that links the militaries of the United States and Europe. Official Washington is staging an elaborate birthday party for NATO on April 4th. That's also the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, who more than half a century ago indicted the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. We spoke with Ajamu Baraka, the lead organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace. Baraka says the NATO birthday party is a celebration of state violence.
Exactly, and it really represents a real desecration of that day. That not only do we have the continued suspicions that the U.S. state was responsible for Dr. King's death, a death that many of us attribute to the fact that he came out in opposition to the Vietnam War as he was moving toward building a broader coalition of forces to oppose U.S. capitalism in the form of building the Poor People's Campaign. And this was a part, we believe, of the counter-revolutionary thrust of the U.S. state, and it resulted in his death and the attempt to undermine the Black Liberation Movement. So now we have NATO coming to town, NATO being an aggressive, militaristic instrument of white supremacy, coming to town to celebrate its 70th anniversary on April the 4th here in Washington, D.C. So we are organizing and we will be in place on April the 4th to express our opposition to NATO when the foreign ministers meet on that day.
We can safely surmise that Dr. King would be appalled that NATO's tentacles are now being extended into South America, with Colombia being some kind of associate member, and Donald Trump flirting with Bolsonaro in Brazil.
Exactly, and it really exposed the true nature of that structure. It is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that was put in place, theoretically, to prevent military aggression coming from, at that point, the Soviet Union. But with the demise of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, that alliance continued. And it expanded in its scope and mission to reveal that it is, in fact, an instrument of the pan-European white supremacist colonial capitalist project. It's been used as an instrument in Afghanistan and Syria. Of course, it was the main element that was responsible for the destruction of the Libyan state. It was the instrument that was used in the criminal assault against Serbia and the process of breaking up the Yugoslavian state. And now it's expanding using the so-called global partners way beyond the North Atlantic, with countries like Colombia now being seen as a so-called global partner, and the proclamation by Donald Trump last week that Brazil should not only be a global partner, but perhaps a full-blown member of NATO. So what we see is the true character of this structure. And that's why for us in the Black Alliance for Peace, we say that we've got to identify the enemy. And we see the enemy as what we call the axis of domination, the U.S., EU, and NATO.
In the now bold and blatant attempt to bring down the government in Venezuela, Donald Trump has assembled a kind of coalition of the willing. But those nations that side with the U.S. in this dispute comprise only about a quarter of the nations of the world, most of them white.
Exactly. We see the global dichotomy that's developing, even more so today than in the past, where you see that it is the nations of Europe and the U.S. and their vassal states that have lined up in support of this gangster move by the U.S. to impose a political leadership on Venezuela. The vast majority of the countries on the planet recognize the Maduro government and are in open opposition to this illegal and immoral move on the part of the U.S. and Europe to impose its will on a sovereign nation. So the global contradiction between the vast majority of the peoples on the planet who are people of color and the desperate attempt by the U.S. and Europe to maintain this global hegemony by any means necessary is becoming more and more apparent for many of us around the world, and it's helping us to be more clear about what needs to be done going forward in terms of building a global movement to oppose the continued attempt at hegemony by this dying pan-European project.
You're the lead organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace, but maintaining peace means more than just suppressing bombs and guns and bullets. The United States has weaponized the dollar like never before.
Exactly, and the dollar hegemony is part of the structures of white supremacist power that we refer to in the Black Alliance for Peace, along with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. Dollar hegemony and the control of the international financial and monetary policies of the globe is part of a very important instrument of control by the U.S. So, yes, we see that hegemony being able to be manifest in the siege that the U.S. and Europe has placed Venezuela under, the illegal and immoral sanctions, and the real sufferings on the part of the Venezuelan people as a consequence of this illegal activity. So part of the response from many states now is to look at how they can free themselves from this global hegemonic dollar that right now still has its grip on the international economy.
The Mueller investigation has come down with its verdict that there has been no collusion between Donald Trump and the Russians, but based on his actions in foreign policy, there was never any evidence of collusion.
Exactly. The collusion that some of us have been more concerned with has been the collusion between the U.S. state and Silicon Valley with the big tech companies to undermine the people's access to information, to narrow the terms of discourse by controlling the access of information and critical analysis. So Russiagate has been a very successful instrument in, fact, doing that. So this collusion among the ruling elements has always, to us, been the main danger to the little bit of democracy that exists in the U.S. Now that the collusion question has been officially revealed as a fraud, it remains to be seen how the liberals and even some of their radical allies are going to regroup now to keep the U.S. population diverted away from the structural contradictions we should be dealing with and still focus on their obsession with Donald Trump.
As part of the fallout from Russiagate, sites like Black Agenda Report were put on blacklists, and the Black Alliance for Peace can't say what it wants to on Facebook.
Exactly. We are still being censored on Facebook, but more so on Twitter. It's interesting that we are putting out comments like, we support peace and freedom in Venezuela, and we're told that that is violating the community standards of Twitter.
Peace and freedom violate community standards.
Exactly. So I guess we really aren't part of their community, and they have standards that are completely alien to ours. So, but we're going to continue. We have to use these instruments for as long as we can. But again, this is reflective of the neo-fascist constraining of information and analysis that we can thank liberals for.
You were part of a peace delegation that recently went to Venezuela. What was your assessment in terms of how the Maduro government's supporters are standing up?
Well, one thing that we came away with was that what we see in Venezuela is not a question of a Maduro. It is an issue of the people supporting their process, their Bolivarian revolutionary process, a process that transcends individuals. And they were quite clear about that. So Maduro is the face of that process. And of course, there is support for him in that sense. But they are very much aware of the fact that they have to defend their process in Venezuela, not only for themselves, but for the entire region. So we took away that lesson. We also saw the spirit of the people in Venezuela who are committed to, again, supporting their process. We had a chance to meet with officials and with non-government organizations and in communities. And one of the messages that we brought back, in particular, coming out of a meeting with the leadership of the Afro-Venezuela communities, is that they wanted us to come back and to tell the people that they are committed to peace. They want peace, but they are prepared for war. But they want us to be very clear. We need to try to prevent any escalating armed conflict in that country, because while they are prepared to struggle and to protect their process, they know in that process, many, many innocent people, many, many people are going to lose their lives. So our responsibility that was solidified as a result of this visit is to come back and do the work to try to educate the public, point out the moral and political contradictions of a Trump regime with their Democratic supporters claiming that they're concerned about the humanity of Venezuelans to justify their intervention, and comparing this so-called concern they have for the humanity of Venezuelans to the lack of humanity, the lack of concern for Palestinian lives, for example. In March, it represents one of the anniversaries of the March of Return, in which the Israelis in Gaza responded with massive lethal force. So these contradictions we have to point out. People can think and they are rational. They just have to be sort of awakened to things as they are so they can think for themselves and stand with the people of the world who are trying to transform their conditions, and that with this backward and dying political and economic system here in the U.S.
In Colombia, Venezuela's neighbor, blacks and native Colombians have suffered more than any others in the decades of civil war, but there is still no peace there.
There's no peace, and the struggle for trying to bring about an effective peace process continues. In Latin America, even beyond Colombia, there's been perpetual war. One of the downsides, the issues we really have with what is unfolding in Venezuela is that by bringing in the war criminal, Elliot Abrams, we know that they are setting up in Colombia along the border a situation very similar to what they set up in Nicaragua. They're going back to that 20th century playbook to develop a Contra army that will be engaged in cross-border activities and that will have as its objective to bleed the Venezuelan state. So the struggles for transformation continue in Latin America. We've gone now from a struggle around democracy in which a number of progressive governments came to power to now more open struggles that will house a military component in Latin America, because the U.S. recognizes that in order for it to be able to maintain its control in Latin America, and because it's lost all ideological legitimacy, its only real resort now is the use of military force. It is really important, Glenn, that black people in the United States understand that when they are silent or even give support to the plans for Venezuela, that they are objectively siding with white supremacy. That basically what they are doing is that they are giving a weapon to Trump and the Democrats to murder and to repress black people and people of color in that country. We can no longer afford to be innocent, not to know what's happening in places like Venezuela and Colombia and other parts of the world. We have a moral responsibility not only to be aware, but to be an effective opposition.
That was Sajamu Baraka of BAP, the Black Alliance for Peace. David Swanson is an activist with World Beyond War and publisher of the influential website War is a Crime. Swanson says Russiagate has dramatically increased tensions between the two nuclear superpowers.
One of the big problems with Russiagate, other than its encouragement of the acceptance of claims without evidence, has been its distraction from the numerous crimes and abuses and offenses of Donald Trump, for which he ought to have been impeached on day one. But another impact of Russiagate has been the increase in the hostility toward Russia, including by President Donald Trump, with the full support, in particular, of Democrats in Congress. And this development of this culture we now live in which there's something nefarious and suspect about Russia and any contact with Russians, not the Russian government, but Russians entirely. And we have a president in Donald Trump who has sanctioned Russian officials, evicted Russian diplomats, bombed Russians in Syria, sent weapons into Ukraine, has pushed against Russian energy deals in Europe, has pushed for the expansion of NATO. Yes, he said NATO was obsolete. He also said we shouldn't have more overthrow wars, and we've made the Middle East worse with all these wars. He has demanded that NATO member countries invest far more heavily in weapons, and most of them are doing so. He's talking about adding Colombia and Brazil. They've added Colombia as a partner. NATO's talking about adding Georgia and Ukraine, which is absolute madness. And I haven't heard a single voice from the U.S. Congress, and certainly not a single corporate media outlet, oppose NATO. It is more beloved than God, apple pie, you know, assault rifles, prisons, and fossil fuel subsidies. It is universally beloved by those in power in Washington, D.C.
And now we have Dr. Martin Luther King's Assassination Day coming up, and instead, the U.S. government is celebrating NATO, a huge instrument of war.
Yeah, peace activists, of course, remember April 4th, not just as the day we lost Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but also the day exactly 1 year earlier when he gave that speech against the war on Vietnam at Riverside Church on April 4th, 67. And NATO remembers April 4th as its birthday in 1949, and it's coming to Washington, D.C. to celebrate itself. And you and I are taking part in some of the events from March 30th through April 4th, opposing NATO, unwelcoming NATO, and celebrating instead the nonviolent activism of Dr. King and the opposition to racism, militarism, and extreme materialism that he called for in that speech. And people should check out notonato.org. There's a huge list of events to take part in D.C. and around the country and around the world, and things that will be live streamed and things that you can do online. I'm looking forward to seeing you there, Glenn.
What's the shape of the peace movement in the U.S. Congress?
Well, it's more partisan than it is peace. There are principles and then there's partisanship, and the latter is the more powerful. There is the possibility that for the first time since its creation in 1973, the War Powers Resolution will be used to send a bill to the White House demanding that a particular war be ended. This would be the war on Yemen. Trump has threatened a veto. We need to demand that he not veto and that Congress override if he does, and that they then end another one and another one and another one until they've got no more wars left to end. That's the upside. The downside is you've got talk and bills and legislation to forbid ever ending certain wars. No troops ever home from Syria. No troops ever home from South Korea. Let's not have any peace in Korea because Donald Trump seems to like it. And that's at least as dangerous, maybe more damaging than the good being done by the move toward ending a war. And then you've got yet another budget proposal from Donald Trump to move yet more billions of dollars from almost everywhere else into the military. So you'll have well over 60% of the money that Congress will vote on every year under this new budget, if they approve it, going to one and only one program, militarism. This is outlandish and outrageous. And you've got all of these progressive candidates for Congress, including Senator Sanders, who's been moved by public demand to talk more about the military budget and opposing militarism. And you've got all these detailed proposals for policies coming from Senator Warren and a number of, there's dozens of candidates for the Democratic nomination for president now. And not a single one of them has even hinted at, even roughly, even within $100 billion, give or take, what they would like to go where in the federal budget. I think that has to be the first obvious question for anyone who wants to be president. Show us your budget. Is 70% for militarism, for wars and war preparations, too much, too little, or just right? What would you make it be? There's not a single corporate media outlet that will ask that question of any candidate, so we have to ask it.
Donald Trump has built upon Barack Obama's legacy of weaponization of the dollar. And it now seems that dollar weaponization is almost indistinguishable from the military hard kind of war.
Well, they certainly overlap and go hand in hand. And the reason I talk about that military budget is not just all the wars that it produces, but the fact that it kills far more people simply by existing than through any of the wars. 3% of it, of just the U.S. military budget, never mind adding NATO, which gets you to 3/4 of the world's military budget. 3% of it could end starvation around the world. 1% of it could end the lack of clean drinking water around the world. You look at what's being done to Venezuela with economic weapons, and it's killing people, just as economic weapons kill people here in the United States. So there's more than one way to commit violence. There's more than one way to kill somebody. And the United States is intent on destroying the government of Venezuela, with Russia having sent Russian troops in and Donald Trump demanding that they get out. Of all the slaves that Rachel Maddow must imagine that Vladimir Putin has around the world, Donald Trump has got to be the worst behaving slave of them all. I think the peace movement needs to build on this global opposition to NATO, this opposition to a war machine that makes up 3/4 of weapons dealing and of military spending, of which Russia spends 7% what NATO spends. There are events this week, there have been and are going to be in coming days, events all around the world opposing this agenda. We need to build those global alliances so that we can push back against this global war monster.
That was David Swanson, A World Beyond War, speaking from Washington.
Haiti has been occupied by foreign militaries ever since the United States overthrew its elected government in 2004 and was the victim of several U.S. military invasions and occupations in the 20th century. Haitians have been taking to the streets by the hundreds of thousands, demanding that their U.S.-backed government step down. Daoud André is a Brooklyn-based radio host and an activist with the Committee to Organize Against Dictatorship. We spoke with him last week.
Today, the 29th, is the anniversary of the Constitution of Haiti. 1987 Constitution, so that's 32 years. Today is the day that the referendum happened, where people came out to vote massively for the Constitution, but really because the Constitution had a clause in it that said that for 10 years, Duvalierists, anyone associated with the Duvalier regime, it would not be able to occupy any public functions. So this was the key to getting people to come out to support this constitution. So today there were supposed to be large protests in Haiti, but they were called by the opposition. The protests did not materialize as they had called for another round of the pays lock. Pays lock is like a complete shutdown of the country has happened for close to 10 days, from February 7th to around the 17th. So these protests didn't happen. For some of us, Glenn, the issue is that the people of Haiti are ready to rid themselves of Moïse however way they can. Moïse, of course, is the little clown, the little thief that the United States has installed to replace Michel Martelly, who was another clown, steward of the United States. But the respectable opposition, I can say, they want to find a solution that is, what can I say, acceptable to the United States. But the United States wants Moïse. And so this is a problem. In this opposition, they are kind of torn, you know, between trying to keep up with what the people want and what the United States want. And this is contradictory, and there's no common ground possible between what the people of Haiti want and what the United States want. Is the people of Haiti, they want a free sovereign country, a country that is working on behalf of the people. But the United States, when I say the United States, I should be clear. I mean the United States, Canada, France, you know, European Union, the core group they call themselves in Haiti, the Friends of Haiti, they dare to call themselves. They want everything for themselves. They want all the resources of the country to benefit foreign corporations. And they want assholes. I'm sorry for using Mr. Trump's term. They want assholes where they can go and they can do whatever they want. Like you saw that they had the Haiti vote against Venezuela, and Haiti yesterday, again, I understand that there was another vote at the OAS where, again, you know, this is about allowing humanitarian aid inside of Venezuela. Again, Haiti voted against the government of Venezuela and President Maduro and with the United States. Of course, the reality where, as we saw last month, terrorists that had come into the country with weapons of war, and the United States just came in, took them out, and no questions asked.
You're speaking of the U.S. mercenaries who were arrested outside the central bank in Port-au-Prince.
Yes, we call them terrorists, you know. But definitely mercenary is also a possible term to call them. The people of Haiti call them terrorists. And the people of Haiti believe that they were brought in by the Haitian government and the U.S. government to terrorize the population into submission to accepting the Jovenel Moïse as president of the country.
The prime minister blurted out and later retracted that they were sent to kill him.
Absolutely. And the day that he was called by the Senate, along with his minister of justice, who signed the document that released these terrorists, U.S. terrorists, five Americans, two Serbian nationals, and one Haitian man who's a terrorist as well. The Minister of Justice didn't even show up. And the joke is that on the same day that he was waiting for a quorum at the Senate, the Chamber of Deputies fired him. 93 deputies out of, I think, 120-something, but 106 were there that day, 93 of them voted to fire him. So the testimony that his minister of justice, who was not even there that day to answer the questions of the senators, it became moot as to who these people were, what were they doing in the country, and why did you order their release? You know, the prime minister's staff didn't even know, that's what they say, excuse me, that they were ordered released and that they were on a plane to the United States. They, supposedly, the prime minister found this out in the press. And, of course, today he's fired, Jean Rissier. He is fired. All of the other ministers remain in function, although the Constitution says once the prime minister is fired, the entire government is fired. But he is the only one who was taken out, and government is running as usual. You know, and right now they have an interim prime minister, and many of us feel that someone who was in the prior government, that they're going to continue to function until the end of Jovenel Moïse comes. We are working so that it be sooner rather than later.
And so what kind of mass movement on the street can we expect in Haiti?
I don't know. I think that as to mass movement, it's going to happen for us just like it happened last July 6th and 7th, something that is not announced. You know, the respectable opposition, I'm talking about the political parties, you know, like the major movements who are on the radio every day, they have this tendency where they wait for historical dates, like February 7th, this was the anniversary of the ousting of Duvalier, and also that's in 86, and the inauguration of President Aristide in 91. November 18th, the prior series of demonstrations, this was the anniversary of the Battle of Vertier in 1803. October 17th, the anniversary of the assassination of Jean-Jacques Dessalines. So for us, it's going to be something like July 6th and 7th, something unannounced, something out of nowhere, because the reality of the people, it's not changed. The high cost of living, you know, this is like amazing. I think the dollar, when Martelly came to power, it was something like 40 goods to a dollar. And today it's over 80. It's like double. And it's not like the people who are working in Haiti are getting paid much more. And for many people, what is sustaining the country is remittances from Haitians who are out of the country. It is corruption that is putting a lot of illicit dollars into the economy. It is just gangsterism, corruption that is rampant in the country right now. So we don't think it's going to be something that is announced. And I think it's going to be something that is going to be done against the will of the opposition, quote unquote, because the opposition, they end up having the same master as the people in power, because they don't want to create a reality that the United States doesn't agree with. They want to please the people and to please the U.S. government, and it's not possible. Glenn.
Does anything change for the people of Haiti when there's a change of administration in Washington?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, Obama, the Clintons, they treated Haiti as a shithole, and Trump calls it a shithole, but both of them, they do the same thing. Jovenel Moïse was the first, to call him a head of state is kind of funny, he was the first person to send a tweet congratulating Nicolas Maduro on winning the election in Venezuela. And because Haiti is what it is, it is a hole, as Mr. Trump says, the same Jovenel Moïse, on the day of Maduro's inauguration, he votes against Venezuela, against Maduro. But he's voting against Maduro at the OAS while he has sent his representative to Maduro's inauguration. And the United States, I know that the listeners might have heard that last Friday there was a meeting at Mar-a-Lago, Trump's elegant shithole, you know, where he had five representatives from the Caribbean there: Haiti, Dominican Republic, Jamaica, St. Lucia, and Bahamas. And these happened to be five of governments in the area who had voted with the United States. I don't want to say with Trump, but with the United States, because this is U.S. policy. What's going on in Venezuela is U.S. policy. This is the Democrats and the Republicans together who are doing this against the people of Venezuela, who the listeners know, they pick a little clown out of nowhere, and then they decide that he's president of Venezuela, and then they twist arms and they get their lackeys to vote at the OAS and to do this. And I want the listeners to understand that a democratic administration would have done the same thing. You know, the problem with Trump, I think when Ilhan Omar, congressman, I think from Minnesota, said that he's less polished than some prior presidents of the United States, but the end result to us in countries like Haiti, the rest of the world, it's the same thing. You know, basically treating the world as if, like the representative of Russia said yesterday, you know, when Pompeo and Trump, they're like, the Russian military needs to get out of Venezuela. And then Russian representative said she didn't know that Russia and Venezuela, they were provinces of the United States. But this is the way the United States treats the world. And it's not just Trump. This is Democrats and Republicans. We want people to be clear about that. Our organization, Comocoda, Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship, we fought against Hillary Clinton, and we are still doing that because on the 11th, they're having, Bill and Hillary are having their little clown show in New York at the Beacon Theater, and we will be out there protesting it as well. But we did not protest because we thought in any way that Trump would be something different in the United States. But we protested because of what the Clintons had done to our country and other countries around the world. And we wanted for people who might not be clear about it to know that just like everyone else, we understand what our interests are. We understand just like everyone else that we have a responsibility to fight for our interests, regardless of the odds, regardless of what the consequences might be. So we don't feel there is any difference between Democrats and Republicans as to U.S. foreign policy. Definitely not.
So U.S. policy towards Haiti remains the same, hostile and oppressive. But Bill and Hillary Clinton, well, that's personal because they personally have committed crimes against Haiti.
Absolutely, absolutely. And these crimes are ongoing. Martha Lee is a product of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Jovenel Moïse is a product of Bill and Hillary Clinton. This is for us like the economy of Haiti being in the condition that it is. You know, Bill Clinton apologized for destroying the agriculture of Haiti, the rice, the major crop. Daily, Haitians eat rice. And he took responsibility for that. But taking responsibility for it and doing something about it is two different things, because still today, the Haitian rice farmers, they are not able to get the resources to produce. They don't have access to the Haitian rice market because rice from Arkansas, rice land, it's being dumped. Subsidized rice is being dumped today as we speak in the Haitian economy. And the rice that is organic, you know, natural rice that is produced in Haiti, that is better rice, well, the people cannot really afford to buy it, and thus the farmers cannot afford to grow it. So the damage that the Clintons have caused, for us, it's ongoing. And we had laughed, you know, when this thing came about the Russian collusion business. From the beginning, you know, we thought it was very funny that the Democratic Party and the press over here, the people who thought that, not just thought, but who said that Trump would never win this election against Hillary Clinton, you know, they came up with this garbage about collusion. And we were laughing when they started this. And we said, wow, like, why can't they see that they're the ones who put Trump where he is, you know, because if they listened, they would have realized that a dog would beat Hillary Clinton, you know, and a dog did beat Hillary Clinton. But, yeah, you know, I see that today, even after this Mueller thing and William Barr's four-page thing, that people are still saying that it's still the Russians who did it. But I think they should sit down and understand, and maybe they can do something next time, and Trump will not be there anymore. But I think the way they're going, Trump will be there again. But, you know, I want to say at the same time, it Trump for us in Haiti, despite the thing about Shul, despite the TPS situation, Trump is not the problem for us. U.S. foreign policy, not just towards Haiti, but towards the rest of the world, is the exceptionalism of the U.S. Like, you know, this idea that the U.S. is meant to rule the world, you know, like this idea that every country in the world needs to be subservient to the United States. The U.S. needs to have everything. Iraq's oil. They need to have Libya's oil. They need to have Venezuela's oil. They need to have the coffee from Colombia. They need to have the cocaine from Colombia as well. But, you know, I think that American citizens, people here, should really sit down and say, this is not reasonable. This is absolutely not reasonable. Whatever it is you want for your child over here, every mother, every father wants it for their child. And as much right as you have to the resources of your country, everyone has it to the resources of their country. And so I think Democrats and Republicans and Greens and, you know, whoever is organizing in the United States need to really to sit down. And we always say, do not go and, like, do good in Haiti. Like, you know, don't bring us water bottles. Don't bring us bags of rice. Don't bring us Band-Aids. But fight here in the United States. I think Malcolm X said this, you know, like he didn't need any white people to come and join his organization. But what he wanted was for white people to organize in their communities so that the problems that black people have would not be what they are. And it's the same thing that I would like to say today to U.S. progressives, American people in general. Instead of going to do missionary work in our countries, because it's not just Haiti. Fight here in your country so that this mindset that the United States needs to control everything, you know, be on top of everyone, and that, you know, it's the crumbs from your table, the bones that you're done with, that's what we should have, that this is no longer the reality that people around the world are dealing with. And I think that it will be another world if this happens, because I don't think, besides the paternalism, all the other things that are wrong with it, I don't think that there are enough missionaries to feed every hungry person around the world. So look at what you are getting out of this relationship that the United States is trying to have with the world, and then address that, fight here, create another reality in the United States. And then the rest of the world can live without having to have the United States and these European countries disappear for the world to be able to breathe.
That was Daoud André speaking from Brooklyn, New York.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, is also an acclaimed author who has written extensively on the violence inherent in the U.S. state. U.S. war makers have long had their eyes on Venezuela.
Several years ago, during the early days of Hugo Chavez's presidency, U.S. forces supported a coup attempt against him, and the barrios of Caracas exploded in support for the former military officer. The people of the capital came forth demanding his immediate release. And Chavez was released. The Americans, of course, denied involvement, but everyone knows otherwise. Latin America has seen the bloody paws of the American empire. And they've seen it for the better part of a century, and it has never been pretty. More recently, the New York Times has reported that the Trump administration has been in contact with Venezuelan generals, and they try to get them to betray their country's government. The White House denied it, but everyone knows otherwise. Maduro, Venezuela's elected president, is at heart a Chavista, for he admired his old boss, President Hugo Chavez, and he cherishes his memory. Don't believe for a moment claims that the U.S. government cares about the Venezuelan people, for we need look no further than America's colony called Puerto Rico. After hurricanes and storms ravaged the island, the White House called them ingrates after they demanded help from their brother Americans. Trump threw paper towels at them. This is true. And he denied them any kind of real support. They were left to swim or drown in the face of a natural catastrophe. May I remind you that Puerto Ricans are Americans, and American citizens, no less. No matter. For when they needed help the most, they found they were on their own. You think they care about Venezuelans when they don't give a damn about Puerto Ricans? Does that make sense? A leopard, they say, cannot change its spots. An empire cannot change its ways.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from inside the Pennsylvania state prison system.
Salinka Makana is a scholar at the Institute for Research on Women, Gender, and Sexuality at Columbia University. Makana was born in Kenya and specializes in studying African women at war. She's author of a recent article titled Contested Encounters Towards a 21st Century African Feminist Ethnography. Dr. Makana says the social science of ethnography must be decolonized.
We need to shift our understanding of what knowledge production really is in terms of, because knowledge has been colonized over time. We come to know what we know through the Western lens, right, through a Euro-American lens. And so for me, what's at stake for me as an African feminist, specifically researcher who's interested in telling stories of African women on the continent, positive stories or even negative stories, but in a different light, is how do we tell stories of our people through their own eyes and through their own voice, or without the filter of a Western voice or a Western lens. So the colonized ethnography is sort of understanding or tearing down the barriers that come with knowledge production, understanding African voices or African women's voices on their own terms in terms of what experiences are, how they self-identify themselves. And so for me, to be an African feminist who's situated in the West but comes from Africa, there's so much at stake in terms of how I produce knowledge that I produce and how that knowledge also gets to be consumed and who is consuming that knowledge and for what purpose. And so for me, decolonization is about putting African women's voices at the center of understanding the world.
You write that a decolonized ethnographer works toward the empowerment of her studied populations. But much of Western social science says that's wrong. You shouldn't be taking sides.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the thing. It's the issue of empowerment is important here as well, right? Again, when we think about empowering, we have to think about what that term really means. Like, you know, there's power, like who has the power to actually empower the other? There's always an assumption that somebody else is coming in to the continent or to the villages, whatever they are, as experts. And that's something that I'm trying to push back against. African women, specifically who are the centers of my research, already have these knowledges, already have solutions to their problems. So rather like researchers from the West going into Africa, assuming they know what the problems are and already have the solutions, that doesn't help time and doesn't take us anywhere. That's why we have so many NGOs in different places in Africa, but the situation is still the same, right? Because people are coming in with solutions from outside without actually taking time to understand the conditions that have led to the problems that actually they're trying to fix. And so for me, it's about empowerment, in that empowerment, African women already have, they already have the power, they already have their own sense of empowerment. So it's about actually going in as a researcher, taking time to learn the people and their culture and their language, whatever it is, and then like listening to them and like together coming up with a collaborative project where the solutions come from them as opposed to solutions coming from outside.
The women that you went to Angola to interview have had experiences that are not common to most women in the world. They are former guerrillas in the civil war in Angola.
Absolutely, yes. That's the crux of my research in terms of what it is that I do. I work around women and war and women's memories of war and their role in nation building. And the women I interviewed, who are mostly ex-combatants in the Angolan Civil War and also the Wars of Independence, have a lot of experience in terms of what it means to be a militant woman, in terms of what it means to be a strong woman, in terms of what it means to be a revolutionary. And so for me, it was important for me to just sort of understand the complexity of Angolan history through women's voices. They have a lot to teach those of us who claim to be knowledgeable on the area of militancy and militarism in terms of what it means to be strong, militant, and revolutionary. And they work with other women. They work with other groups as well. So militants doesn't really necessarily mean, according to the women I interviewed, it's not just about taking up guns and protesting and all that stuff. It's actually about understanding the socioeconomic and cultural histories that are embedded in colonialism. And for them, it was about fighting the Portuguese colonialism. And so how did they mobilize themselves? How did they form solidarities in ways that were actually helpful in terms of mobilization and steering the conversation beyond what it means to be an independent Angolan nation? They had a vision. And usually when I think about African women, that's what I realized in my interviews, like, we see them as being apolitical, like they do not have any political stances, which is not necessarily true because the women I interviewed are all very political, right? But then the way they enact their politics is not the way the Western subject understands enactment of politics or militancy.
Just as women as combatants in war are seldom studied, you write that African women are generally ignored as a class, as intellectual subjects.
Absolutely, and it's unfortunate. It's not just about politics, it's also about knowledge production, it's about academic spaces. African women, they're never seen as actually knowledge or cultivators of knowledge or producers of knowledge. But they are producers of knowledge. For centuries, for millennia, African women have always found ways to actually tell about their cosmology, tell about their worldview, but we don't see them as valid knowledge producers or as valid intellectuals compared to, for example, male intellectuals. We can just go back to the liberation movements across Africa, right? Even the African diaspora, where like this, we talk about the founding fathers, we talk about these male nationalist leaders, we talk about male intellectuals, we talk about the Kwame Nkrumahs, the Jomo Kenyattas, we talk about the Nelson Mandelas, or you know, the Milka Cabrals. But then if we're to ask anybody in the audience, like, can you mention at least two or three women you can think of who sort of within the same period that you would actually call as vanguard, as intellectuals, people have to think twice. When actually women, African women, were actually not just mobilizing behind the scenes, but they were very, very instrumental in sort of coming up with knowledges or ways to steer the anti-colonial movement. And so for me, what's at stake for me as an African feminist specifically is sort of shift our understanding of who is an intellectual in the African context, who counts as an African intellectual, and how do women produce knowledges in spaces that are not traditionally seen as intellectual spaces? If you're a woman in the village, for example, how can we understand the field, the cultural fields as a side of knowledge production? So I look for spaces where African women enact these intellectual spaces or sites that sort of escape the conventional understanding of how knowledge should be. Knowledge is not produced in the academia. Knowledge is also produced in everyday spaces and in everyday lives of women. And so that's the narrative I'm trying to shift in terms of understanding African intellectualism.
Yes, what can American feminists, including Black American feminists, learn from African decolonized ethnographers like yourself?
That's a great question. I think there's a lot that Western feminists, including Black feminists specifically, and that's the good thing. That's one of the most important things about African diasporic solidarity building and intellectual productions, because it's a mutual process here. And so if you think about Black feminism and the way it has inspired somebody like me, who's an African feminist, in terms of thinking outside of binaries, right, that has been one of the, you know, the traditions of Black feminist theory that sort of has opened up spaces for me in terms of understanding the complexity of women's experiences. And so I think there's a chance for African women or African feminists like myself and my Black feminists that have a dialogue in terms of pushing the narrative of what Black women's intellectualism, broadly speaking, really looks like and what it really means. And so there's a lot that women on the continent can really teach feminists out here in the West in terms of enacting everyday politics of survival, everyday politics of resistance that do not necessarily have to be seen to be like in public spaces. Because if I were to give an example of the women I talked to, I interviewed most of them in Angola, and they're just my own experiences in my village, for example. These women enact agency in ways that in the Western context will be seen as a form of oppression, like will be seen like to be in a very domestic, so-called marginalized spaces. But we have to realize that in certain cultural and economic settings, there's no room for this binary of public sphere versus private sphere. And so that's where African feminism and the colonial ethnography becomes interesting. And it has a lot to offer to Black feminists.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.